In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
A country's economy is an expression of the amount of freedom its citizens have. The options, the freedoms you have to do business and pursue happiness. Who is allowed to buy or sell, and from whom? Do your competitors get incentives you do not? That's a freedom disparity. How free is the free market in a given country? An economy is also a culmination of incentives found within a country. The pursuit of the American dream has led to more wealth than other countries because here you're rewarded for your hard work, while the focus of many other countries is to take away your wealth and share it with others who do not equal your ambition. That robs the ambition from most, leading to a majority of, why even bother? Other countries also have positions of power and influence, inherited or due to one's political party affiliation, and closeness to those in power. Alarmingly, this is the direction America is headed. You will only succeed if we allow you to succeed. But wait, you say, China's not free. That's right. Their economy is also an expression of the freedom its citizens have or don't have, because you can make a tremendous amount of money from slave labor and forcing people to buy your goods and pumping public funds into approved businesses, altering your currency to make other countries' goods more expensive and your own less expensive, and to rob other countries of their intellectual property and innovations as a price for doing business, giving China decades of artificial advancement. The lack of freedom is also a direction America is heading. We are quickly modeling China's approach. The Federal Reserve has purchased hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate bonds lately, with large chunks of their debt owned by the government. How do you think those companies will respond to government demands? Like Apple suddenly announcing they have the right to rustle through the contents of your phone. Buried within the Democrats' $3.5 trillion spending plan is billions for leftist organizations. One such scheme is a Climate Corps, an Acorn Redux, where they want to fund 1.5 million climate organizers, activists, and agitators, like Acorn's hordes of community organizers. They will go around to harass and police businesses to ensure they're complying with the green initiatives and social justice, and worse. Assuming they get, on average, a low salary of $40,000, that is $60 billion for Democrats every year. Which candidates do you think they'll donate to and be trained to campaign for? And that doesn't even include health insurance, nor a lifetime of government-funded pensions. And that's just one scheme. Imagine if the NRA had pushed for public funding for 1.5 million Second Amendment door knockers and activists. I think the left would suddenly be shrieking about government not funding politics. As you'll hear in a bit, this bill will fundamentally remake the American economy. America is being torn apart by our own government. It's sad to think we can't trust government anymore. But then again, not trusting government should be the default position of every patriot. You love the country, not the government. On today's show, it's the economy, the Democrats' plans, and also a look at what the heck is going on with the supply chain. I'd like to welcome now Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, A-L-E-C. You can visit them at alec.org. Jonathan, it is great to talk to you again.
Well, likewise. And as you know, I always say greetings from the land of make-believe. But unfortunately, that gets, either more funny or more tragic every time I say it, given the developments out here in Congress.
Oh, yeah. A little more realistic for sure. I mean, it's just astounding what's going on there. And unfortunately, a lot of people are so busy with everything else that's going on is that they're just not focusing on this tremendous bill that I think will totally transform America, to use Obama's words there. And I'd like to start with this massive spending bill, or bills actually maybe in Congress, as to where things stand now. What is the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill? Is it a replacement for a normal budget? Is it just 1 year's worth of spending? Does it include the infrastructure bill, or is that something separate? So help us sort all of this out.
Well, those are very, very good questions. I wish we had a clear answer to that. And that's actually part of the problem, right? Is that even for those of us who observe and are based here in Washington, are following kind of the day-to-day progress or lack of progress on some of these measures and discussions, the goalposts continue to move every day, every hour of the day in terms of what it actually may include. And in fact, we have not, Mark, seen real legislative text in a lot of cases around a lot of these ideas that are being discussed. And so there is this so-called budget reconciliation, and that's a somewhat of a deceiving term. And given that when you hear the term reconciliation, you kind of generally think that that's bringing things together and reconciling, right? And it's the exact opposite of that. That's Washington speak for a truly partisan budget proposal that avoids the filibuster and avoids the supermajority threshold in the United States Senate and allows on a 50-50 margin, as you know that we have, it would allow Vice President Harris to break a tie, and it would be something that would be very radical in terms of its scope and expansion of government power, as I'm sure we'll talk through, and that's what it would do. It's not going to get a single Republican vote, I think is pretty clear, and it would have to be done on a strictly partisan basis. Then, of course, separate from that, you have the discussion over funding the government. The continuing resolution, the CR, as it's called around Washington, will, I think it's set to expire December 3rd, and if not extended beyond that, we did risk a government shutdown discussion again. And then on top of that, you have this idea of a so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill, a smaller version from the reconciliation package. Unfortunately, this is Washington speak again, because it's neither bipartisan right now or very much infrastructure right now, given that I think less than 10% of that bill is actually devoted to things that most people would consider infrastructure. So those are a few things that are moving. Of course, you've got the debt limit discussion as well. That was a little bit more heated a couple of weeks ago. That's been punted off until probably December or January, likely. And so there's a lot of moving pieces, as you can tell.
I would feel so much better about life right now if it wasn't Mitch McConnell with his finger in the dike. I mean, I don't have a lot of faith right now in what's coming out of Washington. But what we're hearing from Joe Biden himself, who is hardly an economic savant, is that this is all paid for and won't cost us a penny. Really? I mean, how do they come to that price tag of $3.5 trillion somehow equals no cost? Because that's the message that we're getting. It's not going to cost anything.
Well, yeah, you have to come up with some pretty tortured intellectual jiu-jitsu to be able to come up with the line that it would cost nothing, given that, you know, there's massive tax increases. We'd all see our rates go up on individual income, and employers would see their rates go up. The United States would be less competitive than communist China, Mark, if we had the approach that many would like to see, raising our business tax rate from the Trump tax reform of 21% up to 26 or 28%, perhaps, putting us at the very top in the industrialized world once again. This would be, you know, lots of different tax increases included. Now, being floated this week by Elizabeth Warren and others is the wealth tax on unrealized capital gains of wealthy individuals. All kinds of other, you know, taxes and fees being discussed, as I'm sure we can talk about more, such as natural gas taxes and other things that would impact everyday Americans across the board. But, you know, that being said, though, it's not even just that it's $3.5 trillion. It's actually worse than that. It's because Washington math, the way that it works, they're able to use some real accounting gimmicks and actually hide between maybe $1.5 and $2 trillion, where a nonpartisan and actually left-leaning group, the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, has estimated that the actual price tag of this so-called reconciliation package is $5 or $5.5 trillion when you look at it on real accounting basis. So there's some big numbers here, some the things that would certainly indebt the United States for decades to come when it comes to raising the deficit, raising the debt, but also making America less competitive and just reversing so much of the progress that we saw during the Trump years when it comes to tax reform.
Yeah, it sounds horrid. And Jonathan, I know both you and I are married, so I need to tread lightly here, but when Biden says this is all paid for, it won't cost us a penny, it sounds suspiciously like a wife justifying how much she saved by spending $200 on a pair of designer shoes. So, okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we're going to be talking some more about how they plan to pay for this. It's going to transform the economy, and not in a good way. Jonathan Williams is co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report by ALEC of competition among the states and a ranking of their economic outlook. You can find out more about that by heading to richstatespoorstates.org. He is also the chief economist and executive vice president for policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. You can find out more about them by heading to alec.org. That's ALEC.org. And, of course, we'll link those up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And, Jonathan, speaking of ALEC.org, on an ALEC podcast about a month ago called A Price Too High, you said that this $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill appears designed to, quote, remake the American economy. Can you elaborate on that? What would it look like on the other side of this bill?
Well, it's kind of a scary glimpse to a future. If this were all to kind of all the ideas that are percolating around Washington that really contain kind of the progressives' wish list from the last 10 years of failed policies that they want to just put together. They realize they maybe have a very brief moment in time in which they can pass what they'd like with a simple partisan vote, unfortunately, in Congress, as we were describing the reconciliation process. That would do everything from kind of Green New Deal when it comes to energy policies and the natural gas tax that would cost the average family another maybe $250 a year, taxes on people that have been trying to quit smoking, let's say, and would turn to vapor and other non-combustible products that dramatically raise taxes on those individuals. You know, it'd be the something to in terms of remaking America, unfortunately. It's some of the ideas around the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, a group that is popularity rating in the United States has to be pretty darn low in most given years, especially around tax day. If somebody's been through an audit lately, you look at polling and, most people think the IRS is overly intrusive now. And some of the ideas being talked about in Washington would hire upwards of another 87,000 new IRS agents over the next 10 years and increase the IRS budget by $80 billion. And if that wasn't bad enough, Mark, you go and look at some of the ideas on snooping into bank accounts. I'm sure everybody's seen that in the headline news in recent weeks, that they've altered the proposals a little bit over time here. But essentially, the IRS could go into the bank account or to Cash App or Venmo or Square account that you might have as a business or an individual. And if you have transactions of over $10,000 aggregate throughout the entire year, could go in and actually say, we're going to look at your bank accounts and snoop without any due process. This is an incredible violation of individual liberty and privacy. So
absolutely.
A few of the top line items there, but it gets worse from there. You could just keep going for an entire hour kind of talking about all these big, bad ideas.
Yeah. Did the Soviet Union treat its citizens this badly?
Well, I'll tell you what, I have heard a couple of members of Congress. One is a good friend of mine who grew up on the other side of the Iron Curtain in Ukraine, who now serves in the United States Congress. And she talks about some pretty scary parallels to some of this big government, big brother surveillance state type items that are being talked about right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. Let's zero in on one of the craziest things that I've heard, and this has to be one of the most dangerous and harebrained ideas I've ever heard when it comes to economics and taxation. And it's not being floated by some idiot pundit on CNN, but it's being floated by the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, Janet Yellen. She wants to tax unrealized capital gains. This is money you haven't earned yet. And when I hear that kind of nonsense, it sounds to me like they just run out of things to tax. So can you explain this monstrously stupid idea and the impact it would have?
Oh, I mean, it would be absolutely disastrous when it comes to markets. It would be disastrous for folks who are looking to save and invest. But it absolutely makes no sense when it comes to tax policy either, because you've actually seen no cash flow on the inside if you had a unrealized capital gain that's sitting there as an asset, but you don't have the cash to pay for some sort of a tax on the asset. So it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy that would force people to liquidate assets that would, for no other reason other than tax reasons, instead of doing what they need to do to ensure their retirements or the retirements of their kids and their grandkids, and they're working on building a business or working on property management. And it would absolutely alter the way that transactions happen, because people look at the tax implications over it over anything else. But I mean, it's absolutely a out of left field tax policy idea that would be a crash and burn tax policy idea, no doubt about it.
Oh, absolutely. And just to clarify for people who aren't quite familiar with this, basically, the way that current tax law works is you buy, say, a stock for $100, and over the course of a year or two or however long you keep it, it goes up maybe to $200. And what they're looking at, and you don't actually pay taxes on that until you sell because of the volatility there. You may sell it at $200, you may sell it at $150, you may sell it at $300, you may sell it at $50. And so you don't actually pay the tax until you've cashed out at that point. Now they're looking at saying, well, if you bought it at 100 and it goes up to 200, we want you to pay tax on that $100, even though you haven't cashed out yet. And so my question is, how long before they do away with just taxing billionaires and move on to, gosh, all those middle class people are sitting on unrealized gains in their property values. Let's tax that.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I think they've got constitutional problems with this as well, that I think is going to be litigated, probably be held up in courts for a long time. But I think to your point is, sure, they could say we're aiming it at Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and others and maybe 200 billionaires. And then it expands pretty quickly when they realize that, guess what, Mark, you know, billionaires hire some of the best accountants and lawyers out there to navigate their affairs and avoid taxes. That's one of the reasons why I think you ought to avoid income taxes altogether, because it's those of us in the working class and those of us across the country that are, you know, working on just trying to make ends meet in order to they're paying, you know, a good percentage of the taxes out there. And those that can afford the tax avoidance strategies like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and others, guess what? They're going to find their ways around that. Or we're going to have a lot less billionaires that are headquartered in the United States, and they're going to headquarter themselves, you know, overseas, and they're going to move their tax residencies that way to avoid this tax. I mean, that's not good for America either. Right. Mm. We need to be making more billionaires in the United States, not fewer, and having them leave because of tax reasons.
So I'm seeing a lot of pessimism in the economics channels I watch. And no one seems to be saying, oh, things are just fantastic right now, unless you work for the government. I mean, has the Biden administration turned into Baghdad Bob on the economy? And if so, what are some more of the worrisome things that you're seeing?
Well, you know, obviously top of mind as I talk to state legislators across the country is what they're hearing from constituents is, you know, what is going on at the gas pump, right? And what is going on at the grocery store, whether it's, you know, supply chain issues to some degree with some products. And as we get close to the holiday season here, that's going to certainly hit pretty close to home for a lot of us. But, you know, when you go and you see what is actually happening to my, you know, disposable income, what is my standard of living going to do if inflation continues to be at, you know, a 5% clip? Or, you know, the great economist and former CEO Andy Puzder says if some of these proposals in Washington go forward, we could be looking at double-digit inflation. Mm. Where, you know, what does that do to gas prices? What does that do to products across the board? That's something that we have to have a really good analysis of. How do we go from here as a country, and how do we turn things around in order to get America moving in the right direction again?
Yeah, turn things around. I think that's the key point here, because coming up, I'd like to talk to you about then versus now. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. Everyone stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at one of our favorite organizations, the American Legislative Exchange Council. To find out more about them and what they do, go to alec.org. That's ALEC.org. And we've got that linked up at iSpyRadio.com as well. And Jonathan, in the time that we have left here with you, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about then versus now. I mean, how is it, you mentioned earlier about gas prices shooting up. How is it that with Trump, we had a far better economy, more people working, and yet no supply chain problems like what we're seeing now, especially when you had some 4 million people that still haven't reentered the workforce, but we're somehow to believe, according to the government, that things are so great right now that it's causing all these bottlenecks and increasing gas prices?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, we made so many unforced errors as a country, you know, over the last, 6 months, especially last 9 months, probably, when it comes to public policy, right? And we were paying for the longest time. I think maybe last time you and I were talking, Mark, you know, we were talking about this issue of government issued benefits for that were incentivizing people not to work, mm-hmm. And paying people not to work, taxing people who work. Guess what? We have a real problem with people that exited the workforce. And, you know, to some degree, it's difficult getting those folks back to the workforce, as we've found out. So certainly that exacerbates any kind of supply chain, you know, issue there. And, you know, we've got the issues around the ports. Certainly, no doubt you see those stories. You see that, for instance, you know, perhaps some of the unions have been holding up, some of the work hours that, you know, maybe ports across the world had been working 24 hours around the clock for a long time, if not indefinitely, where all of a sudden that's just the new announcement that we're going to actually catch up and start doing that. And so I know, like, talking about logistics companies, I mean, our friends at UPS and FedEx are kind of ready to go and just waiting to get things off the boats to get them to American driveways, you know, as they go into businesses. But, you know, that's something that I think we did make a lot of real mistakes in terms of playing with the power of big government, unfortunately, and it's unintended consequences. You know, there's a lot of people that wanted to do this for the right reason and pay people to stay home that knew that, you know, maybe they wouldn't have jobs there. But, you know, we didn't think about, I'm thinking up in Congress mostly when I say we, they didn't think about the unintended consequences of those policies, that when you incentivize people not to work, you're going to create some really long-term challenges for us as a country. And of course, that's what happened.
Yeah, well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about the port situation. We're actually going to be doing a lot of that with our next guest, Janet Jarvis. And I saw an interesting article from Zero Hedge that it is essentially alleging that the Democrats are now resorting to extortion to get this $3.5 trillion bill passed. And a lot of us have wondered if the port situation itself has been a manufactured event. And it looks like it may not only be, but the Democrats, as I said, are using that to extort people. And here's what Zero Hedge had to say. Transportation Secretary Pete stated, quote, "The overall Build Back Better vision is designed to reduce inflationary pressures. So if you care about the inflation, you ought to care about not just the supply chain issues, but also the provisions in Build Back Better, like paid family leave, making it easier to afford childcare or community college, that are going to give us a stronger labor force and help us deal with that major constraint or economic growth." That sounds suspiciously like blackmail to me.
Well, and I tell you what, as an economist, you can't take that with a straight face to say we've got to tackle the problem of inflation and let's put more dollars into the economy through this massive new government expansion and $3 or $5 trillion more spending and expect that it'll actually tackle inflation. I mean, the classic definition is too many dollars chasing too few goods, of course, to Milton Friedman's point of inflation. And so when you talk to people like Andy Puzder, who I mentioned, being the former CEO of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, the restaurant chain for 20 years before being President Trump's nominee to be Secretary of Labor, he said with no uncertain terms, you know, look at what's happening with inflation. If everything that's being talked about in D.C. passes, we could be looking at 10 or 11% inflation. But then the other point he made, which is so key, is, you know, there's a lot of talk out of the White House right now and kind of spin coming out of the press briefings talking about how people's wages are up. Well, when you look at actual wages, real adjusted for inflation wages, wages since this administration took office in January are down.
Yes.
Down, Mark, not up. So that's an important part, that inflation tax is eating away people's earning power. And it's just something that should bother everybody, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, Vegetarian. This is a problem for everybody across the board.
You mentioned 10 to 11% in inflation there. Does that qualify as hyperinflation? Because we're starting to hear some people, most recently, Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, saying that's what he's expecting. So is that hyperinflation, or is that even beyond that 10 to 11%?
Well, I think that's probably even beyond. I mean, you look at the, kind of the classic definitions of hyperinflation in recent terms, at least abroad, it's much higher than that. But I mean, for U.S. standards, this is, you know, may qualify for in that category. I think the thing that we all need to worry about, though, is not just the inflation, but it's the kind of the double whammy in economics of stagflation that we saw with Jimmy Carter, when you have no economic growth and high inflation at the same time. And I'm afraid that if some of the ideas like raising the business tax and raising individual tax and some of these things on capital gains that we've been talking about, if that all happens, you make America that much less competitive and you make us higher tax in communist China than France, than Sweden, than some of these really high tax countries. You see jobs going offshore again. You're seeing companies invert and become, let's say, European companies or Chinese companies or Mexican companies instead of U.S. companies for tax reasons. And you add that with the inflation, and that's the double whammy, I think, that would knock America's economy out for quite a while.
So in the time that I have left, in a rather disturbing news, an In-N-Out Burger restaurant had been refusing California's demand that they check vaccine passports. They were fined around $1,700. And when they continued to say no, California decided to close that location permanently. This really does sound like Soviet Russia. I mean, is that the bleak future that lies in store for us if the Democrats pass this bill?
Well, I tell you, as a probably more the frequent than should be from health reasons for consuming a lot of In-N-Out products over the years, I've been a fond customer of theirs. But I do think that that is a travesty when it comes to government overreach, that the government would be that powerful. And we're talking, you know, state in this case. But of course, we've got the Biden OSHA proposed rules that would, you know, apply this nationally and potentially put the really the thumb of the scale of the federal government on private sector employers in this case. This is just huge government overreach, just yet another example that should highlight just how dangerous government overreach can be. Yes. For people that maybe don't even care about what's happening in Congress on an everyday basis.
Yep, absolutely. A country's economy is an expression of the amount of freedom its citizens have, and there we see it. Jonathan Watt, thank you so much for your time today.
Always great to join you, my friend.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.
They're calling it Containergeddon. Container shortages and port congestion leading to disruptions in the supply chain. And just in time for Christmas, wouldn't you know? To talk about what is going on, I'd like to welcome Jana Jarvis back to the show. She is president of OTA, that's Oregon Trucking Associations. Their website is ortrucking.org. Jana, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. I can't believe it's been just over a year since the last time we talked, but you know, I guess time flies when you're trying to save the country.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I was just thinking it was last week, so I don't know.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
Yep. So I asked our previous guest this, but I'd like your opinion on it as well. We had a far better economy before the whole pandemic shut things down. And yet there was no wide-scale supply chain problems like what we're seeing now. So what's the overall picture of the supply chain? Why are we seeing these problems now when we hadn't been seeing them previously?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think you're going to see as many impressions about what is leading to this supply chain problem as there are people to speak on them. But I think at the core of the issue, to some extent, has been the pandemic. If you think about it and how much of the goods that we purchase come to us from China, and the virus shutting down much of the economy there for a period of time, that created a backlog in manufacturing supplies and consumer goods that left a lot of the ships empty for a period of time because they didn't have product to put on them. And so you just shut the supply system down for even just a few weeks, and all of a sudden you're going to have some backlogs that come into this system. And right now, I think there's close to 70 ships sitting offshore in Los Angeles, Long Beach, and much of that is from the pent-up demand that happened earlier in the pandemic. And of course, there have been a number of other issues that have led to that as well, not the least of which has been all of the support that the federal government has given in the terms of the unemployment checks and the stimulus checks that have created financial incentives for people to buy goods. I mean, they weren't traveling. They weren't spending money on hotels and vacations, things like that. So people have been buying consumer goods. And so the demand grew while the supply shrank. And that's where you've created this bottleneck that we're all living with now.
How much is the ongoing shortage of truckers playing into that as well?
Well, that's a piece of it. And part of that is exacerbated by the inefficiencies in the port system themselves. Mm. And of course, everybody's pointing to someone else. But the fact of the matter is we've got truckers that are going into the ports and trying to pick up containers and being delayed 4, 6, 8 hours to
wow.
be able to pick up a container because there is such a backlog of containers. And restricted work hours, the labor force there until the Biden administration started trying to enforce longer hours. And now you hear them talking about 24/7 at the ports. Well, it's not across the board. And so you can be in line trying to wait to get your container and then wait there for all day for it.
Mm.
And so you overlay truckers' hours of service requirements and things like that. You just create a lot of inefficiencies in a system that is not operating at maximum capacity.
So we only seem to be hearing about log jams specifically in California, the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, their sister ports there. rather than in other ports around the nation. I mean, you've got Governor DeSantis of Florida actually welcoming ships there. Is there something unique about California causing these problems? For example, maybe their emission standards.
Well, I don't think that helps. The state of California has some demands on what kind of trucks can access their ports. And that does restrict the ability many companies to be able to go in and engage in dropping off and picking up containers. So that the environmental regulations have a play in this as well. And that isn't the case at a lot of the ports on the East Coast. Not even the case at the ports up in Seattle-Tacoma, where I understand there's a little bit of a backlog, but not nearly as bad up there.
Do we need to look at diversifying ports? I mean, for example, Los Angeles, Long Beach takes in something like 40% of shipping containers through just that one set of ports. Do we need to diversify, maybe looking at other expanding ports like Coos Bay, Portland, and some other possibilities? I mean, we have a big West Coast.
We do have a big West Coast, but Coos Bay is the only deep water port we have in Oregon. The port of Portland is restricted in the size of ships that can call on it, and those container ships are getting bigger and bigger, and so while there are some, obviously, the Port of Portland does receive and ship containers, the volume of traffic is not going to move through, go upriver and move through that port. Coos Bay, I'm always intrigued with that possibility, but they don't have the connector network. They don't have the rail network and the infrastructure in place, even the road network to handle moving large volumes of product through there. So that's kind of a long-term solution and certainly not a short-term solution today.
Is it something that they could eventually build into? I mean, if we do need other ports here on the West Coast, is that something they could eventually build into, or is that just so long-term that it's not even feasible?
Well, I certainly think it's a possibility, but you've got a variety of opinions on that. I think Coos Bay has been looking to expand their port capacities for some time, and so I think that's certainly something the state of Oregon ought to take a look at and support. I think there's some opportunity there for us.
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, let's go and break a little bit early. Stay with us. More with Jana Jarvis, president of Oregon Trucking Associations. We'll dig some more into the supply chain issues, including the big question. And welcome back. We're talking with Jana Jarvis today. She is the president of Oregon Trucking Associations. You can find out more about them by going to ortrucking.org. And we're talking today about the problems happening in the supply chain. And so, Jana, all around the country, we're seeing pictures of empty shelves, things just not getting there. So I guess the big question is, should we be worried? I mean, are things improving? And if not, what would it take to get them to improve?
Well, I think there have been a lot of discussion about supply chain issues, and people are starting to panic. And my husband went out and bought more toilet paper, so I'm sure that is happening. But the fact of the matter is, the stores, I work with many of the large retailers, many of them are suggesting that you shop early for the holiday season this year for your gifts, because they can't commit that they'll have something on the shelf on December 24th. So I think it's probably very smart for us to plan ahead and think ahead. We as a nation are not accustomed to not being able to purchase whatever it is we want to purchase when we need it. One of my friends told me recently that their refrigerator went out, and the refrigerator they wanted to buy wasn't available for over 8 weeks. So they had to just go out and buy whatever they could get it that fit their slot. And that's just not the kind of way we as American consumers have operated in recent history. So planning ahead, shopping ahead is probably a really smart idea this year, because I don't know where the shortages are going to be. Certainly there are a lot of problems with electric componentry. I happen to know one of our OEM truck manufacturers is talking about having a large quantity of trucks sitting down in Los Angeles because they can't get the electrical componentry to finish the trucks. So I needed a new car in September, and the car I wanted wasn't available because they weren't going to have the 2022 models until January because of the electrical componentry. So yeah, there are shortages, and I think we're just at the front end of this situation. So could get worse before it gets better.
I've seen some reports that say that due to the extended time at sea and also the backlogs there at the container yards and the ports and whatnot, these reports are saying that up to 30% of items are damaged with mold and whatnot. And the specific example was a shoe store, a designer shoe store, and the shelves were empty. And when they asked the owner what was going on, they said, well, we got a shipment in and we had to throw it all out. It was all damaged with mold. Is that a common situation for containers that sit there for weeks and months? I mean, are you hearing any of that in terms of the damage that's potentially happening?
Well, I apologize to you. I'm not an expert in ocean shipping, and so I don't know if that's a common problem, but I've heard the same stories as well. And I certainly hear it with respect to a lot of the food products and the ag products that are being exported from Oregon or products coming into this country that damage and spoilage is a huge issue. So you add a month or two at sea and that's liable to create problems with a lot of products.
Sure. Yeah, especially foodstuffs. On Monday, Newsmax reported that in an effort to ease congestion at the nation's busiest port complex, officials said that they will start fining shipping companies whose containers sit for too long at marine terminals. I mean, that starts to get a little worrisome. I mean, is that really the role of government to start managing day-to-day operations at shipping yards? And is it really the shipping company's fault when things aren't moving fast enough to please some government bureaucrats? And add to that, we'll fine you if you don't move fast enough. I mean, we're almost crossing the line into slave labor here.
Is there a question in there?
Yeah. I mean, is it really proper for the government to start fining people because they're not fast enough? I mean, has that happened before?
I think we could have a large discussion about the role of the government in a lot of capacities. But in this particular instance, do you think that's going to solve the problem? I don't.
No.
I think the supply chain problems are much bigger than how long a container sits in a shipyard. I expect that the administration is trying to provide some kind of a financial incentive for I think they think if they fine you or have the promissory fine that you will find a more efficient way to do business. And I will just tell you flat out, labor is a huge piece of this issue. There just are not enough people coming to work. We have huge labor shortages in the trucking industry, and I know that the ports are suffering from labor shortages as well. And you just can't simply find them to make them work harder and faster. Trying to get more of our labor force back to the table to actually do some of these jobs, and there are lots of opportunities out there, and it's getting harder and harder to find workers to handle the volume of business that there is out there. I heard the other day, I was just back at our national convention, that there are 10 million jobs available and only 8.5 million people to take those jobs. So there are lots of opportunities.
Yeah. Like we were talking earlier, the empty shelves, places like California, Florida, and others. But I have as yet to personally see these kinds of things in any store that I go into here in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Is Oregon not experiencing these widespread shortages? And if not, why not?
Well, I haven't seen too much of it myself yet. A little bit, particularly in paper products, like it was at the start of the pandemic. But I expect we will see it more down the road. But as I told you earlier, just trying to get a new car was a difficult for me in September because they just didn't have the parts available to finish the car I wanted. And so I expect that we will see more and more of this in the coming months, but I hope not. But I won't be surprised if we do. Some of the areas, I was just back in the Midwest, and folks back there are not experiencing those kinds of shortages. So I'm not sure where they are happening. I haven't seen it, but then I haven't been out shopping much lately either. So there you go.
Okay. Okay, let's go and take a break. Coming up, who's really in charge? And And we're back. We're in our final segment now on the Ask Mark Radio Show. We've been talking with Jana Jarvis. She's the president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. And we've been talking about the problems in the nation's supply chains. And Jana, the U.S. Transportation Secretary recently bordered on sounding like the Biden administration was attempting to extort people into voting for their multi-trillion dollar spending fiasco. This was an article in Zero Hedge that we'll put up on iSpyRadio.com. And he was basically saying, if you want things to get better, you better let us spend more money. And if you pass it, then we'll let things improve. I mean, that's just me paraphrasing him. But so could this be by design? I mean, let's verge into the conspiracy theory here for a moment. Let's say that you're in the government with a high level of authority that you would need and you wanted to screw things up. Could you? I mean, could someone be doing this on purpose for whatever reasons? And what kinds of things could someone do to follow things up and create disruptions?
There are a couple of infrastructure bills under consideration by the federal government at the moment. The first is an infrastructure bill. I think it's a $1.4 trillion aimed at largely at physical road and bridge infrastructure. And that's a piece of legislation that we have been actively supporting through the American Trucking Association, because this country needs to make an investment in roads and bridge infrastructure. Much of our infrastructure is 50 years old or older and in dire need of repair and expansion in some cases. I mean, I spend a lot of time on the road network here in Oregon and trying to fix the Rose Quarter and the I-5 bridge are top of list for the kinds of issues that we have been dealing with. And so additional revenue to be able to handle those problems is something that the trucking industry is a strong supporter of. The $3.5 trillion package that was being discussed for other kinds of infrastructure had a lot to do with program infrastructure and not necessarily physical infrastructure. And so you and I both know from what we read that the House has been holding up the physical infrastructure bill, at one point the road and bridge infrastructure bill, for several weeks now. The Senate passed it, and they have held it up in order to get the other package passed. And so do I think that there's some machinations happening in D.C.? Yes, I do. Do I think that Biden is behind the ports not being able to handle the capacity that's coming into them? I'm not sure I would tie those two things together. I think there's just a conflux of events. I don't tend to be a conspiracy theorist to begin with, but I just think there's a lot of things operating inefficiently and ineffectively at the moment. And whether some of that is a result of policy probably is the case, but I don't know that that's been designed that way.
Well, I definitely agree that we need to spend on genuine infrastructure. It's when we start slipping in things like the Green New Deal or funding for 1.5 million climate core jobs to go out and harass businesses. That's when I really diverge from what they're trying to do. A big thing right now in the trucking industry, of course, is the vaccine mandates. And the American Trucking Association said that the trucking industry could lose up to 37% of its drivers who would refuse the vaccine. I mean, we're already short. That would just really be just terrible. These are people who kept right on working through the enforced pandemic when many other industries were sheltering in their homes. I mean, that would be awful, but is that in line with what you're saying?
So pre-pandemic, we were short a little over 61,000 drivers. So this has been a long-term issue for the trucking industry. Attracting people into our industry has been difficult. The demand has outpaced the supply of drivers. And obviously, anything then that feeds inefficiency in the system just exacerbates that problem. But since the pandemic, we are now short over 80,000 drivers. It's getting worse by the minute. And certainly, we are very, very concerned about that going forward. We have a provision in the infrastructure bill that I told you, the one that contains money for roads and bridges. There's a provision in that bill that would allow 18 to 20-year-olds apprentice, essentially, to be able to drive across state lines. Right now, you can't get a CDL and cross state lines or handle interstate commerce, even if the product is staying within a given state, but it's designed for out of state. you can't drive that load unless you're 21 or older. And that's been a long-term problem for us being able to attract young people into our industry. And as a general rule, then we get people on their second or third career, and they don't have as many years to spend in the trucking industry. And so the turnover rate is much, much higher in our industry than in other segments of the economy. Mm. So again, another reason we'd love to see that bill pass, we'd love to see that apprenticeship program go into place. I mean, you know, that you've heard the statement that we'll send our young people off to war, but we won't let them drive a load of groceries from Portland to Vancouver, Washington. You know, it's high time for us to take a new look at that particular regulation that's been in place for decades.
With all the pressure on the trucking associations or truckers themselves, especially, and the kind of blue collar work, I find it ironic that the so-called smart people and government bureaucrats all thought they could just order the world about any way that they want, except they find out they can't function without truckers and blue-collar workers. I mean, these are the people who know how things work, who make things work, and work to make things move. The world could, I'm sure, do with a few less bureaucrats. It cannot function with fewer truckers. And yet government seems bent on punishing these industries and the people in them, making demands and mandates. But from where I'm sitting, it's the truckers and the blue-collar people who have the real power here. Do you think truckers realize just how much power, especially political power, they have?
I hope they do. We're certainly trying to engage them and help them understand how much power they do have. But you're talking about, particularly if you're talking about truck drivers, you're talking about people in many cases, particularly the ones that are long-haul truckers, that are pretty used to being in a cab by themselves for hours at a time. And so interacting in political campaigns is not something that they do historically. In fact, they're just probably too busy and not around to do that. So, you know, trying to be able to leverage our industry and really convey what you've just said is the challenge I face on behalf of my members is to try to help policymakers understand just how important we are to the economy.
Yes, absolutely.
In Oregon, 1 in 17 jobs is related to the trucking industry. I mean, we're a pretty big part of the equation, and there isn't a product you buy or use that hasn't been on a truck at some point.
That's exactly right.
So we're pretty important. And when we started this conversation, we were talking about supply chain issues. And I think as more people aren't able to get those refrigerators or those toys that they've ordered for their kids over the holiday season, they'll start to understand the value of trucking.
Yes, absolutely.
To the economy.
Yep, absolutely. Genoa, thank you so much for your time. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Just imagine for a moment if all of the truckers walked off the job in areas where there are mandates. I mean, imagine the impact of that. Talk about a people's revolution. Just park the trucks and say, no more until you get rid of these mandates. All of them. If any industry could force that kind of change, it's trucking. You know, maybe what we need is a national drive out, not just a walkout. You want to tell me what to do? Maybe you should go do what I do. And I'm sure that they think that you've been so beaten down over COVID, they assume that you won't speak up. And that goes not just for truckers, but for all of us. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.